Now, my thinking was that I would speak on this topic for, we break at 5:30, right? So about an hour, no more than that, and then we would see if there was a desire to share some personal experiences on your part about hearing the voice of God. Or if you wanted to discuss some problems that have been raised by what we have said thus far. I'd like to begin with a text from the 17th chapter of the book of Acts. 17th chapter of the book of Acts. This is perhaps the great classical confrontation of Christianity with the thought of the Greco-Roman world, which was, strangely enough, idolatrous. And Paul speaks to the philosophers of that day, the thinkers of that day, and tries to convey to them the idea of a living God who gave his son for humanity, and Jesus being resurrected would be the measuring rod for all of humanity after that. So just a word or two here from verse 22 and following of Acts 17. Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" Now this unknown God was thought to be, this altar was thought to be, a way that the Athenians had of just covering all the bases. They had many, many gods, as you know. And they even worshiped the dead. I was surprised to find that when I was there some years ago, to see that they had altars to the dead. And they were trying to cover all their bases. And then Paul says, "What therefore you worship in ignorance, or you ignorantly worship, I make known to you. God, who made the world and all things in it, since he's Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made by hands, Jewish or Greek. Neither is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things." Now, Paul is actually confronting their idolatry, the idea that God could be made of silver and stone, and the idea that we should worship something that is less in nature than we ourselves are. And so he says now, "He made everyone of every nation, of mankind, determined their times, appointed their boundaries, that they should seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist." In him we live and move and exist. And that's the verse that I'd like to leave on your minds now as we look at this question of whether or not God speaks today. On the one hand, there is a general blindness to the speaking of God. I think if you were to go out on the street and just ask people, "Does God speak?" they probably would, by and large, say yes. But then when you ask them to say how and to talk about the details of their own experience with the speaking God, I believe they would back off from that pretty fast. And so there is a general blindness or uncertainty about God speaking. Stories certainly abound, and The book In Search of Guidance has many of those stories, and I could tell you many from my own life, and I'm sure that you could from yours. But somehow, the stories don't seem to solve the problem. Because the blindness goes deeper than the stories. And signs have a limit. I don't know if you remember what is said in the 16th chapter of Luke when Lazarus has passed away and gone to Abraham's bosom, and the rich man has passed away and gone to hell. And he lifts up his eyes in hell and has a little conversation with Father Abraham, in the course of which he says, send Lazarus to dip his finger that I might have a drink of water or a taste of water, and that's denied. And then he says, well, send him to my brothers. Send him to my brothers so he can tell them what's happened to us. And you know, Father Abraham says something very interesting in that context, if you recall. He says, if they don't believe the law of Moses, they won't believe Lazarus. So there's a kind of general problem that we have with our conceptualization of God and ourselves that keeps us from really having our faith greatly strengthened by stories if we don't already have considerable faith. Now, if we are strong in our faith, stories usually will encourage us and even add to that. But if we are not, the stories may be interesting, but it won't be clear what they mean, and they won't be able to help us much. So that line, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead, is something for us to think deeply about. What really hinders us are those general assumptions. General assumptions. So you can have people who observe healings, miraculous healings, in answer to prayer. But it won't make them believe in God's power to answer prayer. It won't make them believe in such a way that they will pray and people will be healed. They will not be able to pray the prayer of faith. They'll be impressed when others do it, but it will not mean much to them. So there's a real problem here now, and in relationship to guidance, I think it just has to do with the very idea of being in a conversational relationship with God. The very idea of being in a conversational relationship with God just does not seem to make much sense. Now, what I want to do this afternoon is to select four basic general ideas that hinder people. And I notice a number of you have got this book that I've written on guidance, and this material is in part covered in chapter 4, if you want to make a note on that and look at it in more depth than we can cover just in our conversations here. The four negative responses that, and I'm not dealing with these just as if they were objections that might be made to us, but rather I want to deal with them as general assumptions that keep people from being open to entering into a life of hearing the voice of God. So I'm not debating with others, you see. I want to deal with the issues. And I may sometimes talk as if people were objecting along these lines, but I'm really just talking about the problems themselves as they set in our minds. Many Christians, and it may be that you're not troubled by some of these, but most Christians are troubled by one or the other of them and troubled greatly by them. So I just want to address them and say some things about how to deal with them, and one in particular that has to do with the objection that God simply cannot communicate with us today because of the nature of the universe. So let's just go through these now and look at them one by one. And the first two I've said a little bit about already, but now I want to say more. The first one is simply, God would not speak with individuals. God would not speak with individuals. And this is the idea that God is simply too big or too busy, or some people put it in terms of they seem to think that if God had to tinker with his creation, this would be an admission that he didn't do it right the first time. And actually, there's a name for this view. It's deism. And it's quite an old view. And sometimes it actually comes into play with reference to the Bible itself. Deism is the view that God did the work perfectly, so he doesn't have to come back in. And sometimes you'll hear people talking about a fishbowl God, namely a God who has to keep reaching back into the fishbowl to take care of the fish. And this is supposed to be somehow contrary to God's dignity. And so the idea is that he simply would not do this because he's the kind of God who would be above it. And this shows up with reference to the to many churches that really try to honor the Bible. You will find churches that will dismiss the idea that God would speak with individuals on the basis that the Bible says everything that needs to be said. And that's another form of the same kind of view. I sometimes refer to that as Bible deism. The idea that God left us the Bible and just went off and left it and then leaves it for us to figure it out and work with it. It's kind of Bible deism. And now, this kind of view, especially about the Bible, really can't be made to work. The result of it will always be that people fall into a kind of cold, formalistic religion, where they teach and are proud of their doctrines and tend to believe that right doctrine is everything, and that the mere Bible, without any individual leading, is sufficient to provide us with the doctrinal teachings, which are the basis of our salvation. You know, on the other hand, there are very few ministries that will attempt to run on that basis. Even among the most liberal churches, the general assumption is that the minister at least has some basis for his ministry other than just his scholarship and intellectual prowess and cultural standing. It's nearly impossible to keep out the assumption that the minister has some special personal relationship to God that guides him in what he does with the church. And I suppose that one of the most common introductions, or one of the most common invocations of personal guidance, is in the selection of sermon topics and hymns and things of that sort as to what should be done in the services. Now, I'm not arguing against that. I think that's right. All I'm saying is that that presupposes what this position denies. The position says God wouldn't do that. You're always going to be running to God and bothering God to get your sermon topics or to find out what the scripture means or something of that sort. So there's a real tension here. And very few of our religious folk are able consistently to just hold that view that God would not deal with individuals. Those who aren't religious sometimes, and one wonders how they have a basis for speaking, but they are, you know, it's very very often that those who have no faith at all attempt to instruct the church on how it should live. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Or who profess to not believe in God, but who can tell you all about what is proper in relation to God. And this is one of those interesting cases, because I've met any number of people who just think that even though they don't believe in God, it would be beneath his dignity to deal with individuals on a personal basis. A relationship. In the book, I tell a story about from the movie Gandhi about a scene in South Africa where he is walking with a white person on the boardwalk, and a bunch of ruffians come along and start to bother him. And at that moment, the mother of one of them shouts at them and tells them to go away and mind their business. And the minister, he's walking with the minister, and the minister talks about the luck of that. And Gandhi says something to the effect, as I recall, "Don't you believe in God?" Then he answers, "Well, yes, I believe in God, but I don't believe he plans his day around me." And see, that's, again, that same tendency. Now, what we really want to understand is that what might be perceived as the lowliness of God in having to do, planning His day around us, the lowliness of God in dealing with us is really His greatness. That's His greatness, is His lowliness. This is another part of that inversion that we talked about last night in the kingdom of the heavens and the kingdom of human beings. Another part of the inversion is to recognize that actually lowliness and highness simply do not mean the same thing to God as they do to us. And this is seen repeatedly in the life of Jesus, isn't it? I mean, his readiness to be close to people who were not of the right kind or the right social class, or his association with lepers and publicans and all kinds of people. You see, that's an expression of the same thing about God. So what we really have to say is simply that this is just a mistaken assumption about the nature of God, and that's all that can be made of it. The idea that God would not, because it's contrary to His dignity or His status in the universe, is refuted once we understand how God thinks about status and dignity. Jesus was pretty hard on this, really. If you read the 23rd chapter of Matthew, you see Him knocking the use of titles. Ivan has several times called me Mr. Dr. Professor or something of that sort, and I know it's in fun, so I don't mind that. But truthfully, Jesus said, don't call anyone rabbi, doctor, professor, or father. And He Himself lived among us as just a simple, simple man. And one of the occasions where He really gets mad at His disciples is in Matthew 19:14, where His disciples are keeping little children away from Him. And if you read the language there carefully, He really gets mad at them about this and bawls them out and says, suffer the little children to come unto Me and forbid them not, because of such is the kingdom of heaven. So that's a very important thing to get clear on. Once we understand the nature of God, then I don't think we'll have problems with it any longer. Then secondly, let's look at the objection that God simply does not talk to people. And you might be not bothered by this because of your own experience or your confidence in the experience of others. But for those who don't share the same kind of faith and experience you have, they may be genuinely troubled by it. And they may be prepared to pass off your stories and my stories, very much no doubt as Lazarus' brothers would have passed off Lazarus if he had shown up and said, you know, your brother is in hell, and I've been with Father Abraham, and he told me to come and tell you this. What a riot that would have been, you know? And so the testimony of the church and the folks in the church who believe that God has spoken to them is often dismissed on much the same basis. The idea that, well, you know, they're kind of soft in the head or they wouldn't be believers in the first place. So I think we need to say a few things in response to that particular group. And it may be helpful to you in presenting your own faith to think along some of these lines. And the first thing we need to say is that they may not know or believe that God has spoken to them, and they may say, in fact, God does not speak to me, but the fact that they are not aware that God speaks to them doesn't mean that He doesn't speak to them. And we need to say that to them first of all. That we do not hear does not mean that He is not speaking. Isn't it one of the most common occurrences in the world that we don't hear what is said to us? Sometimes, on a strictly human level, that's true, and it happens because of the kind of relationship we have to those who are speaking. I notice sometimes that people who live together cultivate a selective deafness. and makes for more peace in life. Perhaps that's not the best way to handle that. So sometimes people speak, however, and we're distracted, or we're looking at someone else, something else, thinking about something else, and we don't hear them. So the fact that these people have not heard God speak to them does not mean that He is not speaking to them. We need to say that loudly and clearly. Certainly our faith, I believe, is that God is speaking to people generally. In some way, as the Gospel of John says, He is the light that lighteth every person that comes into the world. See? The 19th Psalm, which I mentioned in the previous session, speaks about how His Word goes out constantly to all the ends of the earth. In some form, He is speaking constantly to all people, and I am sure that the manner of speaking, which we call the still small voice in the last session, is one which is fairly constantly delivered to human beings. Sometimes it comes in the form of their conscience. God speaks with their conscience. And sometimes it comes in the form of impressions about the nature of the world and their lives in it. But God is speaking. Perhaps the parallel to the messages that go out, as we all know now, by many sources of radio waves and all kinds of waves. We're sitting here and these things are going through our bodies right now and we don't pick them up. Right? It's kind of disconcerting to think which television program may be going through your left bicep right now. When I was a kid, I had one of these little radios where you had to sort of sit and hold a part of it to make it pick up the station. And my body was the antenna in that case. And I think that's a good analogy. Astronomers tell us that it may well be that messages are coming in constantly from outer space, and we just don't know how to recognize them or pick them up. I think all of that is good teaching now on this point. The fact that we do not pick up the messages that are coming in don't mean that they are not there. But there's another case that we need to think about. It isn't just that they may be coming and we don't pick them up. Maybe indeed God does not speak to some people at least an awful lot. And if that's true, if an individual says, God does not speak to me, then we need to raise the question, why might that be? Why is it that God is possibly not speaking to them? And I think that probably the reason is that many of us would not make any good use of a message which is sent, and perhaps He's addressed us several times, but then He stops because there's no point in keeping on talking to people who are not going to use the message. And so I think a good response to the person who says that God just doesn't speak to me is, well, would you be willing to respond if God did? If God told you to do something, would you do it? I often use that with people who come to me for advice. Students or other people who know me, they come to me for advice. And one of the things I say to them, well, now if I tell you what to do, will you do it? And usually a kind of hesitation comes over them at that point. I try not to be mean about it, but the truth of the matter is, what's the use of telling someone to do and them not do it? And I have told people things to do that I believe would help them, and they just don't do it. They want to kind of, you know, hear about it and think about it and then do something else. And divine guidance especially, I think many folk who seek divine guidance don't receive a word from God because they really are they want to use divine guidance as a kind of gimmick to get their way. They want to be able to solve their problems, and they'd like to have divine guidance kind of on tap so that if they needed it, they could use it. But it just isn't like that. It isn't like that at all. The purposes of God in all of His activities with us they're incorporated in the opening of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your name be hallowed. Your name be reverenced and loved, cherished and loved, I think is a good way of putting that. Father, always nearest, may your name be cherished and loved. May your rule be completed in us, your will be done in us as it is in heaven, and so on. So until we have the attitude of wanting to honor God and do His will, the fact that God does not speak to us does not mean that God does not speak, because He speaks to those who are ready to hear and ready to follow and do the things that He says. So if we want, if a person comes to me and says, God doesn't speak to me, I say to them very simply, well, why don't you go into business with God and see if He wouldn't talk to you about it? If you go into business with God, very likely He'll talk to you. Now, I really haven't ever had anyone come back and say, well, I went into business for God and He still didn't talk to me. You see, because that's really the basis of our relationship. As I said the other night, prayer is talking to God about what we're doing together. Now, the other side of that is really the same. If we're in business with God, we can expect to hear from Him. I feel sure that we will hear from Him. But it just may well be that we've never come to the place where we can truly say, I'm living for one thing and one thing only, and that is to please God, to do His business. G. Campbell Morgan has a statement on this that I'd like to read to you, as well as one by Frank Laubach. Campbell Morgan says, you have never heard the voice of God, and you say the day of miracles is past. I am never disturbed, I make my own plans, I live where I please, and I do as I like. What do you mean by a disturbing element from the voice of God? And he replies, beloved, you are still living among the flesh pots and garlic of Egypt. You are still in slavery. You know no disturbing voice from God. God never points out to you a pathway altogether different from the one you had planned. Then, my brother, you are still living in the land of slavery, in the land of darkness. And I think that's an appropriate response. Now, contrast that with Frank Laubach's statement. As for me, I never lived. I was half dead. I was a rotting tree until I reached the place where I wholly, with utter honesty, resolved and then re-resolved that I would find God's will. See, that Laubach was living in the Philippines. This quotation, by the way, if you're looking in the book, is on page 69. He was living in the Philippines as a missionary among an Islamic people. And he got to thinking about Islam. You know, the word Islam means submission. It means submission. And he heard the talk of the Islamic people about being totally submitted to God. And he said, what in my experience as a Christian corresponds to that? And he was not able to find much that did, because he had been raised in the form of Christianity, where basically the idea was you do God the favor of believing in Him and His Son, and He does you the favor of letting you into heaven when you die. And that was it. So he came there and became tremendously interested in finding God's will for himself and in living in it moment by moment. He has a lovely little book called Game with Minutes. And if you want to receive some good practical advice how to live with your life full of God, it's hard to find a better book. See, his idea was that he was trained in psychology and sociology, and he understood something about the laws of the mind. And he understood that if you would return your mind to God every moment or so, and you would keep repeating that, God would remain in your mind. Because, you know, anything you have in your mind doesn't go completely out of your mind for a little while, right? It takes a little while for it to get out. And if you think of anything, it will take a little while for it to disappear from your consciousness. And he used that law and said, I will return my mind to God every minute. And he devised ways of doing that, ways of praying, ways of having things in his environment, passing from one job to another with a sense of God, and using that to key his awareness of God. And his life was transformed. And if you've never read Frank Laubach, I just urge you to rush right out and read him. You might want to look also at a little book called Letters by a Modern Mystic, where he tells the story about how he was led into this. And in fact, this quotation is from him. And he says, I resolved and then re-resolved that I would find God's will. I would do that will, though every fiber in me said no, and I would win the battle in my thoughts. And he says, it is though some deep artesian well had been struck in my soul. You and I shall soon blow away from our bodies. Money, praise, poverty, opposition, these make no difference, for they will all alike be forgotten in 1,000 years. But this spirit which comes to a mind set upon continuous submission, this spirit is timeless. So for those who are interested in knowing the continuous input, we might say, of God into their lives, the key is go in business with Him, live with Him, turn your life over to Him, keep your mind on Him. Psalm 16:8 it is that says, I have set the Lord always before me, I shall not be moved. And that's what Laubach did. And when we do that, then we are in a position where God can respond to us. All right, well, let's look now at the idea that God cannot speak with us. And once again, you may feel certain that He can because you may be certain that He does. And if He does, He can. But the modern mindset that dominates this society you live in, I'm sure, at least when they're not in church, and certainly dominates most of the world, will say that God has a problem. Because He's so far away. If He's so far away, how can He come and communicate with us here? Because there's all this empty space. Where is God in the cosmos? And that kind of thought really bothers people. They lie awake at night and think about interstellar space and where is God and how can He possibly get to them to deal with them in any way. It puts Him too far away. And there is a warfare between I'd hesitate to say science because I don't think it's science, but something that passes itself off as a scientific worldview. There's a warfare between that and theology. It expresses itself in many ways. For a long while, it expressed itself in open battles between science and theology, but now it expresses itself in a much more subtle way. It expresses itself in terms of how the subject matter of all the disciplines is taught in our universities and schools. For example, ask yourself, have any of you had a course in economics? Anyone? Sociology or political science? Yes. How much space was given to God in those courses? None. See, God has in the world of the modern intellectual academic setting, and unfortunately, this includes a lot of seminaries that I could name, God has simply become irrelevant to the subject matter that's taught in the courses. Just irrelevant. No longer worth even fighting. They do a little of that in philosophy courses, but in economics, for example, you rarely ever hear a discussion of God, even negatively. Now, do you think economic law has anything to do with God? Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And for example, when you read the Bible, it's constantly dealing with economic issues. And money and wealth is a primary topic for Jesus. But you see, that just has dropped away. And it really has dropped away not by intention. Sometimes in America people get all worked up about secular humanists. Did you use that language here, secular humanist? And there's something to be worked up about there, but it isn't a kind of conspiracy sort of thing. There aren't secular humanists sitting around in offices somewhere thinking about what they can do to make the Christians miserable. No. If it were that sort of thing, it would be much easier to deal with. Rather, it's simply a fact that in the higher education system in all of the countries across the world, the universities and the kinds of courses that are taught, the kinds of people that write the books, have become the cultural authorities. while the church has increasingly receded from the place of authority in culture. I think you're going to see a great deal more of that in your country in the years to come, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong, and I don't like to make comments like that because I am an outsider, and you know, who knows? You probably know better than I do, but my sense is that you're going to see a great deal more of that to come. Without making any special point of it, the university now throws its weight behind a picture of reality without God. And the young people in the churches then go to the universities, and there is set up in their heads a cleavage between God and knowledge. And that cleavage leaves the spiritual realm outside of knowledge. Well, so the question really that remains in many people's minds when they've been through this system is how could it be possible that God should get through space to us? Now, part of that's built on the idea that if you want to get a message through to someone, if I want to get a message through to my wife in Los Angeles, I do have to somehow get through space, don't I? So the image of God as located off somewhere in space, so far that light waves have to struggle to get here in several millions of years, really does leave an image of isolation that's quite destructive. Now, I'm going to now build a little bit on what I've already said to you last evening, and I'll begin by just saying simply, space is not the whole of reality. Space is not the whole of reality. If you've ever read C.S. Lewis's little book, Out of the Silent Planet, you know he has some interesting things to say in there about space. And the main figure in there is a person named Ransom, and this man is being taken out of the planet into space. And just a word or two here from that book I think will be useful. Ransom, as time wore on, became aware of another and more spiritual cause of his progressive lightening and exaltation of heart. A nightmare long engendered in the modern mind by the mythology that follows in the wake of science was falling off of him. He had read of space, and at the back of his thinking for years had lurked the dismal fancy of the black, cold vacuity, the utter deadness which was supposed to separate the worlds. He had not known how much it had affected him until now, now that the very name space seemed a blasphemous libel for this empyrean ocean of radiance that they swam through. The way the story goes, as he goes out, up, space becomes alive and filled with all sorts of glorious things. Well, you see, that's really what we believe to be true on the basis of Christ's gospel about the kingdom of the heavens. See, the space is filled with God's kingdom. There's no empty space because God occupies all of it, and his glory is there. Now, many physicists and scientists today do believe that there is something like a mental side to all of reality. We could have told them that, but it would have been cheap science. They wouldn't want to listen. So they had to come through it the hard way, but as physics has moved into the 20th century, and especially towards the end of it, increasingly, scientists that I can identify for you if you want to read them, have come to the conclusion that the physical world is really held together by a unified kind of mind. Those of you, you know Michael Cassidy. You've heard of him. Actually, I was reading, someone told me I should read The Politics of Love. And I think it's chapter 5 or 6. I'm not sure which one, it's kind of slipped me. But there's a discussion in there about what natural law is. And you might, if you haven't read that, you might enjoy looking at it. Because it's a very nice discussion of the meaning of the statements in the scripture that Christ holds everything together. See, Christ holds everything together just like you hold your fingers together when you clench your hand. Your spirit does that. It uses your body, but your spirit is what is responsible for that. And everything is held together by Christ's will. There wasn't anything made that wasn't made by him. Everything that exists is held together
by Him. He is present, therefore, throughout all of creation.
And we had some talk last night about comparing ourselves and our body to God or Christ and space, you remember, how we are present throughout our bodies, but not localizable in it. And God is like that. So, I think we can remain very comfortable in the view that we live in a material universe that both makes divine guidance possible and is in fact upheld by the power of God. Since, in fact, it seems that the universe is a mind and the mind is in the business of guidance, we need not be intimidated by the system that I've been describing. Because, in fact, even scientific thought leaves the door open if it doesn't insist upon the reality of a universe pervaded by mind. So that's good news, because really we face a system that opposes us here on many, many points. It isn't just about guidance. There's a kind of block of contrast that what we might call the secular worldview, or in more biblical terms, the counsel of the ungodly, using the language from the first Psalm, where it says, "Blessed is the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly." The ungodly are just people who have no God. And so they plan everything as if God did not exist. And that's exactly what I was saying about university courses in economics, sociology, whatever. And even Christian schools are not able to integrate God into the subject matter of their courses, even though they try. So very often they have a prayer before they begin their class in a Christian school, but when it comes to talking about the laws of chemistry, there's no discussion of how that relates to God. So there's a real problem here, and I just want to mention some of this contrast because it's a part of this block worldview that says that God couldn't possibly be a part of the individual's life with guidance. Here's some contrast. The counsel of Christ says, people who believe are the ones who know what life is about. People who believe. Belief is better than doubt. We are saved by faith. See, that's the teaching of the way of Christ. The way of the ungodly says, brighter people are the ones who doubt. If you doubt, you're automatically smarter than if you believe. The skeptic is thought automatically to be more intelligent than the one who believes. And you'll find that the university is then a system that is pervaded with what I call dogmatic skepticism. It is a skepticism which simply says that there's no possible way that we can have knowledge about God, about the human soul, and so doubt on these points is always an indication that you're smarter. And dogmatic skepticism, unfortunately, does not doubt its doubts. It doubts beliefs, but it doesn't doubt its doubts. And that's what makes it dogmatic, because if it were a fair, thorough kind of skepticism, it would doubt its doubts as well as doubting beliefs. Another contrast is, here's a good one. I've got a bunch of them here. I can't go through all of them. I'll just give you some of the more striking ones. The counsel of Christ says, the good person follows God's laws and nature's laws. The good person is the one who follows God's laws and nature's laws. The counsel of the ungodly says, you decide what's right. After all, you're free, aren't you? And this will even go so far as to say that you have no moral obligations unless you somehow contracted to have them, to agree with them. Right, there's a lively discussion in many parts of the English-speaking world, and I'm sure you will find this if you go to your universities here, especially the English-speaking ones. There's a lively discussion as to whether or not you owe anything to your parents if you don't like them. And the idea is, you didn't ask them to have you, did you? So if you didn't ask them to have you, how could you possibly have any obligations to them? See, that's a part of this idea this kind of do-it-yourself morality. The do-it-yourself morality normally says, well, do what you want to as long as you don't hurt anyone. Have you ever heard that? Or they're doing something you say is wrong. Well, it's not hurting anyone. Well, the trouble is, you never know whether it's going to hurt anyone until it's long past the time when it's done. And also, people have no regard to themselves. They have no idea the effect of their actions will have on themselves. The secular system says the care of the mind is most important, and if not that, then the body. And really, the body looms very large, but when in passing out rewards, this system does reward brightness of mind and cleverness of mind. Christ says the care of the soul, or character, is the most important thing. The secular system says getting and having and consuming are best. But Christ says giving is better than getting. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Living to give is the name of well-being for the Christian. The secular system says you live a few years and you are no more. And Christ says you live forever. You cannot cease to exist. So be careful about how you're going to continue existing. That's the main thing to worry about. Well, I can go on and on. There's a whole block of thinking now that takes this world and exalts it into the reality. And that world says, God couldn't get through if he wanted to. And we have to recognize how that thinking works, because as we minister to others, and really as we watch our own thinking, we have to be careful that that kind of mentality about reality doesn't really make us just assume the burden of running our lives on our own and not expect God to talk to us. See, the overwhelming presence of the physical constantly batters us. It's there every moment. And if we were to get up in the morning and be as hungry for God as we are for eggs and toast, we would advance rapidly in spiritual things. You see, but we're not. And so the physical batters us with all its feelings and all its needs, and we're constantly into that. But the spiritual doesn't batter us. It just appears gently, easily. If we want to explain it away, we can. One of the temptations that frustrate people's prayer life is that they pray and an answer comes and then they explain it away. They say it was a coincidence. Well, you know, it could have been a coincidence. You really, normally, God doesn't give you things that would just prove to everyone that he's there. I mean, an agile, well-brought-up university student could have explained away the fire that came down on Mount Carmel. You know, just an electrical storm happened to hit. Just when Elijah said, let it come. But there's no limit to where you can go with that. That goes back to the earlier point I was making about how stories don't really change these basic attitudes. If a person is set to explain things away, they will explain them away. And the same thing is true of guidance. A person who is set to explain them away, guidance away, will be able to do it. He'll have some psychological theory or some other account of what is happening. One of the most amusing and interesting things to me recently has been the efforts of people to explain so-called near-death or after-death experiences in terms of chemical processes in the brain. Now, they can't identify the chemical processes in the brain. They just say they have to be there. And they have no way of explaining at all how the people who go through these things could be conscious of what was happening and come back and report truly what was happening from a vantage point away from the body. It just has to be merely some chemical process in the brain. So you see, there's almost no limit that you can go to if you have this general attitude. Well, lastly, not only do we have people who say that God would not, that He does not, that He cannot, but we also have people, these are more often quite religious people, who say that He should not, that He should not do it. And the reason for this is, well, always because it is thought that if God is talking to everyone, there will be no order of authority in the church. And the scriptures themselves may be undermined because people will be citing their experiences over against the scripture. So let's just say to begin with that there is a legitimate concern here. It is true that people often do have experiences, and they try to exalt those experiences to the point to where they're over everything else, the Bible, the traditions of the church, the authorities of leaders, and all of those kinds of things. So let's admit that, and so we can go on, because that's not all we want to say. We have to look at the other side, and we have to ask ourselves, is it really true that leaders depend upon God not talking to anyone else? Is that really true? The Christian leaders depend upon God talking only to them or to no one at all. And I think surely we have to say, no, it doesn't depend on that. It doesn't depend on that. The wonderful story, and I think it is Numbers 11, where I cited that this morning in another connection, but it's a very instructive story, where God comes down and puts the spirit that is on Moses on all of the other elders, you remember? And when this sort of thing begins to happen, it is not under human control. And there were two of the elders that were still out in the camp, Eldad and Medad by name. And as they were out in the camp, they were not in the church house. They were out in the field of the camp, and the Spirit of God went on them, and they were prophesying. And Joshua came in and reported this to Moses, I think it was Joshua, and said, you know, this thing is getting out of hand. And Moses made a very interesting statement. He said, you know, are you jealous or envious for my sake? Don't worry about me, he said. I would that all of God's people did prophesy. I would that all of God's people did prophesy. And I think we have in that the basic answer to this concern. Now, those of you who are pastors may feel more tenderly about this than I do, because I don't presently have the responsibility of running a church. But I do know what it's like to have that responsibility. And all I can say is I believe we have resources in our relationship to God, a kind of an authority that does not depend on Him talking to no one else. And, you know, we really do need to recognize here the dynamics that lead to very destructive religious groups and cultic organizations. And I think I mentioned the first talk I gave that in all of these there will be one person who claims to be the only one that God speaks to. And they take that as the basis of their authority, and then they use that to overturn the most obvious objections to their ministry. And many times the objections are that they are doing sinful things, that they are vile before God and all of that, but the people are overwhelmed by the structure of authorities that is built up around the idea that this one person alone speaks to God. And if you've accepted that, that's pretty powerful, isn't it? Because that means really that the person has power over your life. But we need to understand that there are foundations for this kind of behavior in our culture generally and in some of our churches. And I think the surest defense we have against this is to encourage people to believe that God will speak to them, and to encourage them to find out how that works. And I think we ought really
to regard this as a part of our ministry is to encourage people generally to believe that God will deal with them individually. See, one of the worst things I believe we can do as pastors is to undermine people's confidence in their own individual dealings with God. Even though it may seem that defending authority is important, and it is, still, we carry an authority which defends itself. And it may be that sometimes we will have to have confrontations in which we deal with people, and we may need to take a stand that involves the group lining up to determine whose authority is to stand. But I think we just simply have to go through with that. You know, there are now over 2,500 distinct cults in America. Over 25, in America alone, 2,500 identified by sociologists. And they all operate on the same principle. And it is a form of madness. Religious madness is one of the worst forms, and it becomes a form of madness. And I don't know if you have these kinds of things in South Africa, but we constantly have them. I mean, the thing with David Koresh is just an exaggerated case. And the way we deal with the abuse of a religious authority is to encourage people to know how God speaks. It isn't to try to get them to believe he doesn't speak with the individual. It is to encourage them to know how God speaks, so that they can withstand people who try to dominate them by saying, God told me such and such. Legalism also can be very oppressive, and we need also to be able to escape from legalism. Legalism which says there's a system and there's an order, and everyone just has to accept that, and it doesn't matter what you think about it individually. If you don't accept that, you are not right before God. And we need to understand that there is deliverance from that in a personal relationship with Christ, where there is communication from Christ to the individual. And so until we're doing that, our mainline churches have to ask themselves the question whether or not they are in fact feeding the cult system. By the way, they misunderstand God's individual dealings with people. And I think the answer is that very often they do. There's an additional way in which they do that is they set up a system which starves people for spiritual reality. I don't know if we've talked about New Age in this session here, but everywhere I've gone in South Africa, everyone is just staggering under this phenomenon of New Age. But when you get into New Age in our country, you find that many of the people were raised in standard Christian churches. But they had no sense of spiritual reality. Shirley MacLaine, who in our country is sort of the popular guru of the movement, was raised in a Texas Baptist church. How did we miss her? I know how we missed her, because I've spent a lot of times in Texas Baptist churches. We missed her by grinding away on our doctrine in a way, and our practice, in a way that had nothing to do with her life. We did not introduce her into a living relationship with Christ. Because I don't know if you've read any of her stuff or seen any of the things on it, but or others like her, but the truth of the matter is, the spiritual reality which she supposedly found in the New Age movement, which, you know, always involves the view that you are God, and the great moment of discovery for her was when she discovered she was God, which some of us are still waiting to discover with reference to her in particular. But that great moment, you see, is an utterly unbelievable, fantastic stretch of excited imagination compared to the historical and personal reality of the life of Christ and his people. But if you're cut off from that, and all you've ever heard is Christianity which has none of that, you will think you have heard it and rejected it. So you see, it's extremely important for us to get straight on this and understand that God should indeed speak with his people.
that he should talk to them, if you as we might say, regularly. Not all the time, of course, but regularly. I'm not an advocate of what I call the message a minute view. Many people are. They think, you know, that if you're really in touch with God, why, every 30 seconds a new message is coming down the pipeline. And if you're driving along the road, he's supposed to tell you every move you make. That's not right. And that's not good. That's a part of that smothering thing that has come up in the discussions, and I want to talk some more about that in the morning. God does not smother us, but there is a sensible conversational relationship to be established where we walk with him and we share his presence, and there is communications in both directions. Now, when we have that, then I think we will be able to lead like Jesus. And Jesus led by the authority of his own life with the Lord. And I believe that pastors know about this and that it works, and that others who are not pastors understand that if you have the weight of authority in you from your own spiritual life with the Lord, then you don't need to insist that nobody else is talking to God. And in fact, you can encourage others to talk to God. And the more they talk to God, the better you like it. And if we had more Christians talking to God, pastors would have more time to do other things that are valuable. So, dealing with the head of the body is Christ, and I think that if we approach it in this way, we will see significantly realized in our time the true unity and power of the glorious body of Christ, where every individual is nourished and directed from the head, as Ephesians tells us, and all live together in harmony because of that, and we become a living temple inhabited by God. I think we'll see that in some significant measure, that we can look for it, we can pray for it, we can work for it, we can expect to see it begin to step forth into the pages of human history, as it certainly will in eternity, because it's going to be the light of the cosmos in eternity. It's going to be the standing eternal witness to God's grace and wisdom, as we're told in Ephesians 3:10, if you'd like to look that up and see that. Ephesians 3:10 tells us what the purpose of the church is in eternity. But historically, you see, we're in a period where we need to hold our aims and expectations high. The world is staggering in darkness. How is it to be helped? I think the only way it can be helped is by the people of God being the people of God. And I mean by that, living in this vital, interconnected with one another, with Christ as the head, really showing the world how to live in such a way that if indeed the sacrifice of life is what is required to testify for Christ and stand for righteousness, we're happy to do that. Because we are living in a total world where we know we have nothing to fear. And the assurance of that comes from this living in the manifest presence of God that comes with the conversational relationship. So we're ready to lay down our lives. We hear verses like Philippians 4:6, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, with prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God, and the God of peace will keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Well, I think I want to stop now and see if you have some things that you want to say about problems that you see in what we've dealt with. I ask you to think some time this afternoon, or positively, if you would just like to share something of your testimony as to the things we've been talking about. I think it might be quite encouraging to everyone. And if you want to speak for a bit and tell your story, would you mind just coming up here and talking into this mic? I hope that won't scare you off, but we do have a problem here. And if you want to just make a brief comment, I'll try to repeat it or ask a question. If you keep after me, I will try to repeat that and try to respond to it. So do we have anyone that would care to lead off with a statement or comment? Is what do you do for people who say the Lord told them to dye their hair purple?
Or all sorts of crazy things.
Or all sorts of crazy things.
I think there you start out by doing a great deal of listening to find out why they feel it necessary to say that sort of thing. Usually I think you will find that a person like that is really plagued with uncertainties as to who they are and why they do what they do. And so they feel the need to bolster themselves by some phrase like, "the Lord told me." Others will go different routes. They'll give you a long psychoanalysis of the situation and draw their authority from that. So what I would encourage you to do in a case like that is to listen first and then begin to talk to the person about what it means to say, "the Lord told me." And most of us are kind of defeated, I think, because that, by that. I'm foolish enough to hope that after having suffered through these seminars, you'll have a little more to say to her about that kind of thing. And it might begin on a positive note. It is good that the Lord would talk to us. But normally, a person such as that, it's going to be strange. It will turn out that the Lord is strangely quiet about a lot of other more important things in their life. And one might begin by saying, "What does the Lord say to you about your finances, or your sexual life, or whatever it may be, you know, the way you're dealing with your children or your parents, primary relationships?" And I think I would begin there. Now, if I have a person who truly is walking in the Spirit and in 1 Corinthians 13, and they say that the Lord told them to dye their hair purple, I'll say, "Praise the Lord." You know? If they say the Lord told them to pull it out, I'll say, "Pull it out." You know. So that's sort of the way I would approach it. I would listen. I would try to understand what was going on. And then I would try to gently redirect it, if there is a need, to more important things. Rather than worrying about the foolish things, I would try to get it over to more important things and see if the foolish things wouldn't just drop off after a while. And yes, no, that is true. Yes. Is, what about the cases where you have one step further, namely where someone says, "The Lord told me to tell you to do that." And, you know, I do take a very simple approach to this case, which I begin by saying, "I'm waiting to see what the Lord will say to me about it." What? Another move is to say, "Has he told anyone else?" Because I believe that the Lord does not just tell me things. And that's especially true in families. I'll tell anyone. The Lord never tells me anything he doesn't tell Jane. If it involves our family life and things like that, he doesn't do that. Yes, and so I would just take a kind of common sense approach in that way, and that's the way I would go with that. That gets to really deep issues in their life, though. Because they are being manipulative, they're wanting this actually, if they're Christians, I would take them to the passage in the Sermon on the Mount where it says, "Don't swear." Because that passage is really about invoking God to get our way. That's what that passage is about. It isn't about cussing as we know it. It's about invoking God to get our way. So if they're Christians, I would take them to that and I would talk to them about that. Because they're really trying to use God to bulldoze us. And that is not the Spirit of Christ. Then beyond that, I think I would try to listen more deeply and see what was really moving them and see if I couldn't be of help in that regard. Yes. Well, I think that can be confirmed. And if you have a person who has a confirmed prophetic ministry, you would listen to them in a different way. But you still would ask, "Who else has been told?" You know, the spirit of the prophets is subject to the prophets. And that's a rule we dare not turn loose on. And the revelation of God to the prophets is not a private matter. It's never a private matter. Yes. Question is, why can't I remember to restate the question? The question is about a conversion experience. Conversion experiences are very interesting in this regard. Sometimes they are just the result of the power of the word of truth coming into people's minds and them being open and able to receive it and deciding on that basis. Normally, however, I don't think it does work that way. I think it usually involves, at least at a bare minimum, something like what we're calling the spirit of man or the still small voice. And very often it takes the form of taking a scripture or something a friend or a family member or a minister has said and just sort of writing it in neon lights so that it sits in the mind of the person and brings them, as we say, under conviction. Most conversion experiences are the result of some very special kind of word from God. I don't think all of them are. They need not be. I think they usually are, and especially when we are involved in evangelism, I believe we should expect them to be. We should expect that God would take our words and far beyond anything that we could imagine, make them His word and so bring about the conversion. So the last two things on the list are the means. But of course, there's always the Apostle Paul and people like that. And there really are many people who are converted by astonishing experiences of some of the kinds that we've spoken about, even angels. It happens.